Accession number 28776, reel 12.
Admiral Ray Ragolf, reel 12.
Right, so the next event was to go to be de-symbolized, because up to that stage, aviators, I mean, in the naval list, you had a little symbol alongside you which indicated that you were not qualified as a seaman. So this period was designed to get me qualified as a seaman, which meant I had to get a watchkeeping certificate. So I was busted back to lieutenant and reverted to lieutenant. The first thing I had to do was get my wife back to America, and the cheapest way of doing I think that was the time she went back. I can't remember. I think that was the time she went back Icelandic Air, which was the cheapest way of getting to the States in those days, and had to land in Iceland to refuel, and to be with a brand new, well, I suppose the baby was in about, or Brooke was in about a year old, and to be 18 months perhaps, more or less carried across the frozen airfield there into the hut, because that's all it was in those days, while the aeroplane was refueled, and then on to New York. Then she had to get down to Jacksonville. So it was quite a performance for her, poor dear. And having dispatched her, I then went down to Devonport to join the Varian Bay, which was a Bay-class frigate, which was destined to deploy to the West Indies. And I arrived in the dockyard there in a taxi from the station and finally found the ship alongside. Pouring rain, dark, a cold night. And so I went on board with my gear into this strange environment. And the only chap on board, the only officer on board, was the duty officer, the officer of the day, who welcomed me, and I went down the wardroom, but there was nothing to eat, and so I sat down to read the Times, the newspaper, which my father had always taught me to do before I did anything else in those days. I wouldn't read it today, but then those days, yes. So, as I sat there, just arrived on board, the officer of the day came round and tapped myself, and he said, "Oh, Ray," he said, "there's something I think you ought to know." He said, "We've got a chap, we've got a problem." So I said, "Oh yes, what is it?" He said, "Well, we've got a rating on board, a stoker, that's down in the mess deck, and he's threatening, he wants to go ashore, he's under stoppage of leave, he said he's going to go ashore, and he's got a marlin spike, and he will attack anybody that comes down the ladder into the mess deck, and, you know, we've got a nasty situation on our hands." So I said, "I thought, crikey, why are you telling me? I mean, just walked on board." It transpired, and he said, "Well, of course, the reason I'm telling you is you're the senior officer present." I was senior to him by about 4 days, I think. So I was somewhat irritated by this, and I turned to him and I said, "Well, when it gets out of hand and you can't handle it, let me know." I went back to read my paper. About 15 minutes later, he came back and said, "It's now out of control, and I think it's over to you." I thought, crikey, this is my introduction to general service. So I said, "Right, clear the deck. That's the first thing we do." He said, "But it's raining." I said, "Yes, and they're all going to get wet, and they'll be very angry when they get up there, and they won't like this chap at all." So clear the deck. And those days, in this particular ship, there was no broadcast. You had to go around with a whistle. You know, clear the deck, clear the deck. The quartermaster went around, so they were up on the, in the rain. And I said, "Now, where is this chap?" And they said, "Well, he's down there at Stoker's Mess Deck." So I said, "Right, where's the coxswain, which is the chief regulating officer on board these small ships?" And he came along, he said, "It was, yes." So I said, "Right, coxswain, we'll go down and get this chap." And I said, "You go down first." "Oh," he said, "but sir, he's got a marlin spike, he'll break my legs." I said, "Well, then I'll go down first." I said, "It doesn't bother me. He's not going to break my legs. Why should he do that? He's never met me." So at that moment, the quartermaster came up and said, the engineer officer has just returned on board, who was the divisional officer for this chap. And he was at the end of a narrow corridor in his office. So I said, oh, well, I'll just go and tell him. So I walked down there, and there was this chap in civilian clothes, backed up against the bulkhead one side, and a sailor talking to him the other side, a seaman. And I just walked up, and I said, oh, are you the engineer officer? He said, yes. I said, I've got a problem with one of your chaps down the mess deck. I said, I'm just going down to get him. And I looked up. And this seaman on the other side was the chap. He'd come up. He had a marlin spike in one hand, and it was about 4 inches from my head. And so I looked at him, and I said, oh, hello, laddie. I understand you've got a problem. So he looked at me, and I said, look, I've just come on board. I don't know anything about this ship. I don't know anything about your problem. Let's find some place where you can come and tell me all about it. So I took him. I've always had a guilty conscience about this. I took him off to the quarterdeck, down into the hold under the quarterdeck. And we sat down there in a barrel of something or the other. There was a stowage down there. And I said, now what's all this about? And he said, well, I'm understanding to leave, and I want to see my girlfriend before we sail, and it's all unfair, and I leave. And I said, well, I can't really say anything about it. The fact is, you are under stoppage of leave, and if you break out of the ship, that's a very serious thing to do, and you're it's not worth it. You're risking too much. So why don't you just come? So I said, well, you wait there a bit while I go and talk to somebody. So I came up out of them. What was it called? I can't remember now. And I didn't say the quartermaster slipped the hatch, and so they slipped the hatch, put the bolts on. The chap was then battened down into the after whatever it was. I can't remember the name of it now. And I've always felt a bit guilty about that, because here I'd really misled them, deceived the chap, but it was for his own good. Anyway, I then said, well, that's all that, they can return, and so the chaps all came back a bit wet by now, but they really didn't have much sympathy for this chap. And then the officers returned on board, and I met them and all the rest of it, but I won't bore you with that, because most of that story is all in my book. And we then sailed about a week later for Bermuda, and arrived at Bermuda, and to my astonishment, I was made the gunnery officer of this ship. What I know about gunnery, you can put on the back of a Tuppenny stamp. I mean, they really... So I went and had a briefing by the chief GI, and the antiquated system for gunnery in this ship, all I could do was fall about laughing when it was all driven by chains and winding handles, and I really couldn't believe it. Anyway, I was a gunnery officer, and as a result, I had the gun. And then I had the boys' division. My division was the boys'. In those days, we took boys in at 16 as boys, and at 18. Or 18 and a quarter, or whatever it was, they were graduated to either ordinary seamen or mechanics, stokers. So I settled into, and of course, being the gunnery officer also meant that I was the officer of the guard. I had to have guard duties, so I thought, really, I'm in at both ends now. But it was different, and I enjoyed it, and I made the best of it. And the first guard I had to have was in Bermuda. We then had a commander in chief, West Indies, who came on board, and the first lieutenant said, "We're not going to clean this ship up at all, because we're going to let the CNC see the state it's come out of dockyard," and it was in a state, rusty. But anyway, so that we did. And then from then on it was Bermuda, and then down through alongside South America and down to the Falkland Islands. And I suppose the most amusing, amusing in many ways, the captain was a bit of a recluse. His name was Hare, and of course he was called Bunny. And not only that, but he nibbled. which made him much look much more like a rabbit. And with the boys' division, I discovered that they had no sex education, knew nothing about sex or at all. And I thought this was rather dreadful. So I said to the doctor, we had a doctor, would you like to give the boys a lecture on sex? And he said, no, under no circumstances, no, I'm not going to do that. So I thought, you useless bugger. So I thought, right. Okay, so I said the first time, well, the doctor refuses to give them sex lectures, so I should give them sex lectures. And we said, I think you better talk to the captain. So I went to see this bunny here, the captain, who was more or less a recluse in his cabin. And he said, I understand, Ligo. He said, you want to give the boys lectures on sex? And I said, yes, sir, because they have no knowledge of it at all. And I think this is rather dreadful, and so somebody's got to do it. The doctor won't do it, and so I've decided to do it. And he said, all right, on your head be it. I thought, So anyway, I started filming. I can tell you, after the first hour, the perspiration was pouring off me. And I said, I think we better have a rest. And I went back up and had a cup of coffee and then came down and tackled it again. And so, but one of the difficulties I faced, which was the first time, we had several boys who came from Southern Ireland, and or Ireland. And I remember one saying to me, oh, can't use contraceptives, sir, because the priest has told us they give women cancer. So, that's the kind of thing you're up against, really. And how do you... So anyway, we got over that. The first port we hit was Recife, which had been called Pernambuco in South America. And boys' leave started at 1 o'clock and finished at 6, and at like quarter to 6, half past 6, the paddy wagons were rolling up with my boys. And they'd gone ashore, and they'd gone into the first bar and got themselves a drink, and then they'd gone into the first brothel they'd found, because they'd been taught about sex. Now they're going to try it out. And I had, I think, subsequently 3 cases of gonorrhea and 2 cases of syphilis. So much for my lectures on sex, you know. I mean, really. So I felt very guilty about this, because I mean, we had kind of parental responsibility for these boys, but there you are.
At that stage, were they still segregated for the rest of the ship's company?
Yes, they had their own mess deck. And gradually, of course, the numbers dwindled as they reached so-called maturity and moved on to being ordinary seamen or stokers. So that was one of my episodes again. There were many, many, many episodes in the Varian Bay. But I was very lucky once again. The first lieutenant became a very firm friend of mine. We had the same sense of humour, which is always rather disastrous, or can be. And so, I mean, on one occasion, when I had the boys' division, I'd say, go up and report to him at divisions, you know. And I went up to salute him and said, Doyle's division is ready for inspection, sir. And he said, thank you very much. I said, have you ever thought, sir, of what it must have been like when everyone wore cocked hats? And he said, how do you mean? I said, well, where do you think they saluted? Do you think they... So he said, yes, all right. So I went back to my division. He said, when he had to report the whole ship's company ready to the captain, of course, he had a vision of the captain wearing a cocked hat, and he burst into laughter in front of the captain. He couldn't control himself. And that was the kind of... So it was a very happy relationship there, and I got on very well with all of them, and, but it was an amazing ship in many ways, amazing. I had 2 midshipmen, and they were attached to me for training. And I remember one midshipman saying to me, are all ships like this, sir? And I said, no, they differ. All ships are different, different ships, different cap tallies. And I said, what you've got to do is to learn, when you're in this ship, the good things about it and also the bad things. And then when you get a chance to command, you can reject the bad things and only introduce the good things. But and so we went down to the Falkland Islands, and I did an approach and entry into Port Stanley, which was my final qualification. for my watchkeeping certificate, which I got, and promptly, after 6 months in the ship, which is the minimum time for getting a watchkeeping certificate, in comes a signal from the Admiralty saying, if LIGO is qualified, he is to return to the United Kingdom forthwith, because there's a flying appointment up at Lossiemouth for him. That coincided with a signal coming in down the fault lines. There was no telephone, no mobile phones, remember, in those days, from my mother-in-law in America, saying that my wife had been admitted to a hospital, an emergency hospital operation, and this had been successful, but could I send now $1,000? I didn't have $1,000. In those days, the sterling wasn't convertible, so I had to make a signal back to my brother to say, go down to Caldero's and bring that. I brought an American car back with me when I came back from the States of Kaiserberg. Take that to London, sell it, and get the money, and then they didn't move into dollars, because you could move it in dollars for the reason like that, and pay my mother-in-law back. So that was all part and parcel of but then there was a great episode of the snipe, and that's a very long story, and it's best to read about it in my book. But we had lots of amusement, I mean, in funny sorts of ways, and it was a happy time. I don't think it was always happy for the ship's company as a whole, but I was very happy, and my division was quite well adjusted. And I used to take the boys off for banyans on the beach, because I wouldn't let them go off on their own into various brothels after that. So that was that.
What did you have to do to achieve your watchkeeping certificate?
Well, I had, first of all, to keep watch at sea. First of all, in the open ocean, which there wasn't very much about. Then, to learn rule the road, I had to have to be taught astral navigation. And the final test was to take the ship into Port Stanley for an entry and anchorage and bring her safely to anchor, having brought her in, which I did successfully. So that really was it. It was just a question of watching how I handled the situation in company with other ships. And although we weren't in company very much, but I remember, you see, little episodes make people think you're much wiser than you are. We were going into, where the hell were we going in? Do you know, I can't remember. Montevideo, perhaps it was. Perhaps it was Montevideo. And I used to go up on the bridge just under training, watching this, the navigator take the ship in. And the captain, I had transpired afterwards, I wasn't told at the time, I learned afterwards, appalling eyesight apparently. Anyway, he took his binoculars as we were coming up, and he said, they've got a guard. Do you know they've got a guard, First Lieutenant? So number one said, a guard, sir? Yes, they've got a guard. They're all there with the red, you can see them, they're red uniforms, sir. Well, we better have a guard, right? Guard. So I was the officer, so I had to rush off down to my cabin and get my gaiters on and the rest thing. Guard, fall in. So just as I got everything ready, and chap came down for a quarter mile, says, it's all right, sir, it isn't a guard, the guard is not required. Thank God for that. So I went up, what the captain had seen, that the chief had, because this was an ordinary up and down engines, and he'd ordered many gallons of lubricating oil, and all these barrels were parked on the jetty, and they were white with red bands around them, and the captain thought it was a guard. So, anyway, that was that. But going into wherever it was, we took a pilot. A pilot came on board, a Spanish or Portuguese pilot. And as we started to enter the harbour, there was a boy in the middle. And the navigating officer said, we leave that boy to port, sir. And the pilot said, no, come Porto, you come Porto. He wanted us to go the other side. So there was the navigating officer saying one thing, the pilot saying the other. So there's where we're going, bonk, 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 straight towards this boy. So the captain, he said, well, I'm sorry, number one, but I mean, he's the pilot. He wouldn't know what he's doing. Right, you come around to port. So he came around to port. And the navigating officer then made the immortal remarks of all navigating officers. And he said to his German, yeoman, take all the orders down in writing from now on. Anyway, we went ploughing on through to into the harbour. And when there's the jetty, and we were coming alongside, and the pilot said, anchor, me anchor, me anchor, me anchor. And so the captain said, what do you mean, me anchor? What do you mean, me anchor? Has he got an anchor? Did anybody see him bring an anchor on board? No, nobody saw him bring an anchor. Well, I don't know what he's talking about. I said, I think what he means, sir, I think he means that he's got an anchor laid out. And that's what their boat is, off the jetty there. No, I know what you're talking about. I go, what do you mean, an anchor laid out? No, certainly not. No, certainly not. Anyway, sure enough, when we got there, that's exactly what it was. They had an anchor, and the boat took a line to the ship so that when it came time to come off, you could pull off on the anchor and pull it out. So I was regarded as, you know, top for seamanship for coming to that conclusion, but it was fairly elementary, it seemed to me. But anyway, there we were. And we had all kinds of fun and games. But it was a happy time. And then we left the Falklands and came back up to Rio de Janeiro, where I joined the Andes to come back to England. And I was appointed to Lossiemouth to convert two Sea Fury squadrons to Seahawks. And I was given two vampire trainers. My wife came back. We'd had the house in Helston let while I was away. And so the first thing was, of course, I had to find accommodation for up in Lossiemouth. And the usual argument, everyone said, oh, you'll never find any. Anyway, I did. The place called Innes House was at Maydown. I think it was the satellite for Lossiemouth. And we had the top floor of the stables block or something. I mean, it was absolutely appalling. But still, it was accommodation. And I managed to get them, my wife and my daughter together with me. But then the house in Cornwall became free. So I took her down to Cornwall, put her back in the house in Helston, which hadn't been looked after very well. Anyway, we had all that to clear up. But there she was. And so I had these two vampires, and one I had long-range tanks on. Didn't use it for instruction purposes. I used the other one for instructing. And the one with long-range tanks I used for flying down the Cold Rose every weekend. So that, in those days, those happy days, that's what you could do. And so the time passed, and I converted all these chaps, which was an easy task. I did the two squadrons, and then they said, right, well, now, what are we going to do with LIGO? So,
Abner, when you say that, though, you converted them, it was an easy task. What was the kind of pattern of training that you would give them to convert? How, you know, how
well,
long
I mean,
they
these chaps had all were all qualified pilots in Sea Fury squadrons, and you put them on a vampire trainer and said, okay, now I'm going to do that. You gave them a briefing of what it was like to fly a jet aircraft, how much different it was, how much easier it was in many ways. Things you had to watch out for, things, the difficulties and dangers that might occur, and you just taught them how to fly the vampire. Really took it out stalling. It was not a spinnable aircraft, so it was just a stalls and recovery from stalls and then back and joining the circuit. And being able to control the engine, the difference with a jet, fundamental difference was that in a big Fury, if you pulled the throttle back, then the airplane would physically slow down. Whereas if you pulled the throttles back on a jet, it took a little time. Unless you had dive brakes to put out to slow it down, because it wouldn't slow down very quickly. So getting a measure of this, understanding the difference in the approach pattern and what you could do and what you could see and how to land it, that's all there was to it. It was a fairly simple task. Lossiemouth, because I was still an A1 instructor, and the chief flying instructor was not. He was a A2 or something. And when the trappers came round from the Empire Flying School, who were the... you weren't supposed to test an A1. He was an A1. However, I was put up for a check. I thought, oh, don't bother me. So I had this check with this chap, this flight lieutenant, and somebody or the other. And after we landed, he said, well, that was brilliant. He said, brilliant. So no doubt in my mind, he said, you're still an A1 instructor. So I said, well, thank you very much. He said, one thing I would say, though, if it's your manner, he said, is a little brusque. He said, I thought you were a little brusque. I said, no, really. I said, have you ever instructed sub-lieutenants in the Royal Navy? And he said, no. And I said, and if you had, you'd be a little bloody brusque, too, I'll tell you. In other words, you had to be fairly firm with them. So that was Lossiemouth. And
did they all convert well? Did they all do the conversion well?
Yes, all of them.
Is this really the transition? Because everybody would assume that there may have been more problems, I think, with jet aircraft. But no. As a pilot, it seems to be quite the opposite from what you're saying.
Matt, it was believed, you see, that it was difficult. I never told anybody it wasn't. But actually, it was by the side easier. I had flown on an actual deck. I should have mentioned, I suppose, earlier that when I came back from the States, I had more experience flying jet aircraft than anybody else in the Royal Navy. Nobody asked me about it. You would have thought that somebody would have said, right, we're going to get a whole Liger, and not at all. The only chap that asked me to do it was George Baldwin, who was then forming up an attacker squadron at Ford. And he asked me to come down and talk to them, which I did. Otherwise, nobody talked to me, asked me about anything. And, of course, the other thing, the people that were in the Navy that had got a little bit of jet experience on vampires and everything didn't want Liger to be involved because he obviously would put them in the shade. So, it was that. And this served me in very good stead many years later. And I was serving as DNAW, or DDNAW. And one of my desk officers came to see me one day and said, he said, by the way, sir, he said, we've just got Lieutenant somebody who's come back from the United States where he's been flying Sea Kings. And I said, oh yeah. And he said, would you like to have a Yarmouth? I said, yes, of course. So remembering that no one had ever spoken to me, this chap came in. And at that time, I had inherited a program to go for NAST 358, which was a brand new great big helicopter to replace the Wessex 3. And it was going to be built by Westerns, God help us, at an enormous cost. Anyway, I said to this chap, well, what have you been? He said, I've been flying this aeroplane, I've been based at Key West. I said, fine. I said, it's a great shame. I said that Sea King can't lift the Wessex 3 equipment. He said, how do you mean, sir? And I said, well, I mean, it hasn't got the power and the legs to give us the endurance we want with the Wessex 3 equipment. He said, but it can. And I said, how do you mean? He said, I've just been flying 5 hours sorties out of Key West where it's hot and humid. And he said, and here's the pilot's notes. You want the pilot's notes? He said, it'll show you. And it was then obvious to me, the Ministry of Aviation, or whatever it was at that day, was lying to us in their teeth in order to get Westerns a big aircraft order. And so I went over to America and I flew this aeroplane and I flew the Huey, I flew the Sea King, became the Sea King, I flew the Chinook, and I flew all the aeroplanes, the helicopters that they had. And it was pretty obvious to me. The one to go for was the Sea King, which had already done all the work necessary for hover coupling and all the things you needed to do, which would be very difficult to do in an aircraft which hadn't been properly. So we bought the Sea King, and I think it was about $50 million to bring it over and convert it and put all the helicopters, the Westland 3, Whirlwind 3. What was it called? Wessex 3. Wessex 3. Anti-submarine equipment in it. And of course it became this enormous success that it's been ever since. So that was the lesson that actually came to me by being ignored and I came back. I remember somebody was reminding me the other day, and I'd forgotten it completely, that we'd had the flag officer naval air came round when I was converting these chaps up at Lossiemouth. And he came round and he said, well, now, like, what do you think of the Seahawk? And I said, well, it's a perfectly good little toy. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I've just been flying airplanes that are much more competent than that in the United States Navy. The Seahawk is perfectly nice little airplane, but it's only really a toy. He said, are you serious? And I said, yes, I am. And this chap said, I've never forgotten, we all went dumb, we all went very silent. And Ligo suddenly said, you know, it's not a nice airplane, bloody useless, but it's a nice little airplane. And it was.